Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening, and I could go on, but we're not because we got so many questions and so many good questions, and there's so many things I promised I would talk about. How am I going to get to it all? Rebecca, you've been waiting for a while. Thank you. And so tell me the problem here.
Well, I think a few weeks ago you had mentioned that you were going to go through the process of how to use filler grass for the lawn, you know, as far as scratching the soil and putting down
right.
sod. And I didn't know if you had done that. I think I missed a week in between that.
I haven't, but let's and we can do it. You know, here's the first thing I would do is wait just a little while. I would wait about 4 weeks, but this is the time of year to begin preparing for it. And I'm going to give you a quick crash course here real quick. First, if you don't want to try to patch, it's sometimes very difficult to patch a very small area. It's sometimes easier to patch a larger area because leveling it can be a real problem once you break it. So
right.
just something to think about. You know, if you've got little patches that are a problem. Let's say you've got a patch that's 2 feet wide, okay, just a 2 foot circle. I don't think I would patch that. I don't think I'd bring in sod because it's going to be a mess. I would try to get the centipede to refill that area, and the way I would do that is just to crack it lightly. Take a fork, okay. Just take a fork, wiggle it into the ground, lean back just a little bit, and try to crack the soil there. Don't try to turn it upside down. Don't do anything funny. Just lean back and crack the soil right there. And see if that centipede won't fill it in those little areas. Centipede's a terrible grass, I'll just have to say. It's just terrible. It's really the worst grass for us. It's better in North Alabama than it is here, but it's... But even centipede will begin to fill in oftentimes in those small patches. Larger patch, you know, I'd say, let's say a 10 by 10. I think you can handle a 10 by 10 area or a 10 by 20 area. It would be a good area to patch if you really felt like you wanted to. If I were going to invest in patching an area like that, I would invest in something besides centipede. I might use St. Augustine.
Okay.
So take a larger area. Here's the thing. Do just like go back to where we started. Take a garden fork, wiggle it into the ground, and crack that soil because oftentimes the problems we have with our lawns is that the soil has a hard pan that roots can't penetrate, and you don't want to turn the soil. You want to just crack it.
Yes.
And that breaks that hard pan. You do that. You come back. Very simple. You come back with pine bark. And this is usually a real help. Come back with pine bark about an inch to two deep. Just pure pine bark, each piece no bigger than your fingernail. You can get it from several places. And just get it in bulk and lay it out there about 2 inches deep.
Okay.
Then put a little bit of lime on it. Okay?
Okay.
And rake it out good. Water it. Rake it out again until it's smooth. This is the process of smoothing it. Don't turn it. You're not turning it. You're just raking it out and smoothing it so that there are no, so that your front yard isn't a roller coaster. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And then you're ready for the sod. And you just put the sod on top and press it down. Listen, don't walk on it once you've dug it up like that because you'll create footprints. So what you do is you take a 4x4 piece of plywood to stand on. Isn't that cool? And that way it shifts the weight and presses the ground down evenly. And when you're putting the sod down, use that 4x4. And, in fact, you can use 2 4x4 pieces of plywood. Don't make them too thick because they'll get too heavy. But like a half-inch piece of plywood, you can kind of step around. If you really want to get sophisticated, I guess you could tie them to your feet, but you'd have to walk bow-legged to do it. So there's that. That's the basics. Now wait about 4 weeks, and I'm going to give this lesson again in about 4 weeks because it'd be the perfect time to do the grass But there you got the basics.
Can I ask you one quick question?
Yes, ma'am.
In one of your promos for your show, a gentleman comes on and asks what's the best grass to use if you're not going to irrigate with water. It doesn't ever give the answer. What answer would you give to that?
What's the best grass to use if you're not going to irrigate with water? Well, so here's the thing. I recommend I never use I never have an irrigation system. When you establish grass, you have to have water. There's no way around it.
Right. Yes, okay? I understand.
For the first 6 months, you got to have water. The good thing about planting in October is that you can probably skate by without having any water. If you do it just right, maybe you'll have to water it once. That's the good thing about October.
Okay.
If any grass, centipede is a wheat grass no matter what. But, you know, I don't know that there's any grass that I think is exceptionally more drought tolerant than another. Zoysia may be the most drought tolerant, but generally the problem in our climate is not that we almost get too much rain, and that's where we have the most problem with grasses. So once they're established, I actually don't think most grasses don't need any water, except maybe once a year. And then you can drag out a sprinkler. So there it is. I think any grass is fine.
Okay, great.
Except centipede.
After St. Augustine, what would you recommend?
You know, we don't have a lot of choices. I wish I could say we did. I would say after centipede, with caution, I'm going to say the new zoysias, not the short zoysias, but the taller zoysias. The variety that I like the best, which I don't think anybody's growing anymore, was a variety called Empire and some of its similar hybrids. I think the one they're selling now is called Palisades. It's a zoysia that you can grow fairly tall. It actually grows tall. I don't think it does that well in shade, but probably St. Augustine does – nothing does really well in shade. But so zoysia and Palisades would probably be my pick. I mean, I'm sorry. St. Augustine and the Palisades variety of zoysia would probably be my top two picks. And
This is a sunny area, so –
Yeah. You might try that. You might try that grass – I think in a fairly sunny area with good soil prep, I think it's going to be a fairly good grass. I have seen some fungal issues yet. It's still kind of new, but you might try it.
Okay. Thanks, you, Bill.
Thank you. Good to hear from you, Rebecca. Listen, I got to talk to Mackenzie here. Okay, you going to let me talk to Mackenzie? Okay, good. We got some time. Mackenzie, now tell me, Mackenzie wants to know about transplanting this live oak. And it's I've heard, Mackenzie, that this live oak, you planted it when?
From a 4 years ago. 4 years ago, October.
20 years ago?
Four years.
Okay, sorry. you planted it from an acorn, or was it a little seed?
Yes, a friend of ours planted it from an acorn underneath. He picked it up on the day we got married and planted the acorn and then gave us the tree on our first anniversary.
Yeah. So, So here's the thing. And Mackenzie wrote me earlier and said, look, how deep do I need to dig for the taproot? And let me just say that almost no tree has a taproot. There are two trees that you will encounter that will have significant taproots. Hickories, some hickories do. Pecans do. And longleaf pine does, and almost no other tree has a taproot. So it really isn't a question of how deep you dig. It's really a question of how wide. And here's the problem, Mackenzie,
okay.
And I'm gonna lay out the problem, and then, gosh, I have to take another break, but we're going to be right back, and then we're going to talk about why. The problem is that the tree roots, after 4 years, probably extend about 15 feet out in every direction from the tree. And so you see the problem. It's how you collect those roots back. And there's a secret to doing that, and I'm going to tell you how to do it. It just takes a little bit of time, but you can bring those roots back closer to the tree, and that's what we need to do in order for you to move this tree.
Okay.
All right, so hold on, because I'm going to be right back.
Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, let's get back to this, because Mackenzie's been very patient. She's got a great question, and it's going to be of interest to a lot of you. Mackenzie and I once shared a big live oak. You remember that big live oak, Mackenzie, and that yes. was between our two yep. yards?
Yes, I do.
It's gone.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. And it's a sad story, and we'll have to talk about it sometime. It was a big live oak. It was really big. And it's probably, I don't know, it's a funny story. But listen, so Mackenzie has this live oak that that came from a seed that is very important to her. So I don't have to ask her whether she really wants to do this, because I can tell she really wants to do this. It's important to her. And the tree has been in one place. It's a live oak. It's been there for 4 years. She wants to move to another place. One of the interesting things, when trees develop, even as saplings, they're really developing a huge root system that extends way away from the trunk. If you're in a nurseryman, if you're a nurseryman or a nurserywoman, a nursery person, you would take that tree and you would prune the roots so that the roots stayed compact and around the trunk. And that way, when it got time to move that tree, which sometimes they grow them in a field, then you could just – all the roots would be compact. So they would plow around the tree to just kill the roots and get them to form a more compact mass near the trunk. See what I'm saying? Root pruning is what they call it. In order for you to move this tree really successfully, I'm going to recommend that you root prune it. And it's very easy to do. The only problem with root pruning is that you have to wait. So let me ask you, how long can you wait before you move this tree?
Not very long. Probably, we had planned to move it on October the 12th is the day we planned to move it.
And there's no way you could let it sit there and come back?
We would. The reason we could not do that is the house is for sale. And I don't want someone to come in here and get attached to that tree and say, oh, we'll buy the house, because I've sold real estate and I know people do this. But we have to have that tree in order to buy this house.
Okay. So what I would normally say to do, and this is how I could just about guarantee you success, is to prune half of the roots about 2.5 feet out from the tree.
Okay.
And but the trouble is, you need to give it about 6 months for those roots to redevelop.
I gotcha.
So it's not going to help you to root prune it. Okay. But I'm going to tell you how to do it the right way, and then I'm going to let you see if you can figure out how to work a deal with whoever buys the house so that you can do this by promising to buy them a bigger tree, which would be a mistake, but they won't know that. Tell them, here's what I would suggest. Tell them that you're willing to buy them a bigger tree if you'll just let them take that tree, because that tree is important to you because you planted the seed. Can you do that?
Gotcha. I can try.
You know. Try it.
So that's an emotional issue for people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know. But just tell them you'll give them a bigger tree. People are suckers for big trees, and big trees are not good things, but they don't listen to my show, and so they won't know this. But you tell them you'll buy them a bigger live oak to put there. It won't cost that much. But if you'll root prune half of it right now and let those roots redevelop, leave half the roots intact so that, you know, it will have the energy from half the roots. It can draw on half the roots. Cut the roots on one side, just in a half moon, about 2.5 feet around the tree. Why 2.5 feet? Because that is the maximum size you're going to be able to carry.
Okay.
And so just do that. Root prune it. And then come back. You may even be able to do it in February. Come back in February and then dig it up. Now, let me tell you how you have to dig it up. If you try to dig it up by just levering it out of the ground, it won't work. So I've been taught, and it always works well, to dig a trench. Say if you want a 2.5 foot root ball, if you want the ground to be 2.5 feet, well, you're going to take 2 feet maximum around the tree. That's a 4-foot root ball. That's pretty big.
Okay.
And that's going to be a 2-person job. But you'll make a trench all the way around that 2-foot circle. So just a trench. And the trench is about a foot wide, 6 inches to a foot wide. And it's a trench that goes down about a foot deep. You'll have to take the sod out carefully. And then take your shovel and cut under the tree. Because otherwise you won't be able to get a good root ball. So dig that trench. Then use your shovel. Once you've already cleared out that dirt around the edges, then dig down with your shovel, then cut. The root ball doesn't need to be more than 18 inches deep. Okay?
Okay.
That's all you need. That's about all the soil you'll need. Perfect. But you'll want as much soil around the tree as you can, and you want to have formed some new good roots close to the trunk, and that's why I'm encouraging you to root prune.
Okay.
Give it a try, and you got my number, so call me back if this doesn't work.
Okay.
And we'll
sounds good.
All right. Thank you for calling, Mackenzie. All right, good. Hey, Nate. Oh, man, Nate. I'm ready for this.
How you doing?
Good. I'm ready for this camellia question.
All right. We bought this place about a year ago. We got camellias all over the property. We've been spending the past year kind of reclaiming them. A lot of vine growth over them. And there's these four on the on the north side of our house. We went in there and we cleaned all the vines out and the weeds, and we mulched them with some pine needles, pine straw. And the other three are doing great. And then I sent you those pictures. You told me to look at the base. This one that's not doing so well. Even when I try to look at the bottom of the leaves, some of the leaves are falling off when I do that.
All right, so here it is. So Nate's got this. It's a pretty mature camellia, and it's looking just terrible. And it's about looks like it's about 8 feet from camellias on either side that are looking okay. And so I asked Nate to send me a picture of the base of this camellia, and once he did, I knew immediately what the problem was. So, Nate, I'm going to tell you right off the bat, your camellia has finally evolved to the state that it has a disease called glomerella. I don't have another name for it, but glomerella is not a bad name. I mean, you can almost remember that. It kind of sounds like something bad, doesn't it? Glomerella. It's a fungal disease. It infects trees that have had, camellias in particular, that have had some damage to the trunk, or that grow in very wet soils, or that were improperly planted. The last two are definitely the case here. So let me tell you what I see, and I can tell you the history. This camellia was planted way too deep, I can tell. And the reason I can tell is that you can't – when you plant a tree or a shrub, you want to be able to see the first root emerging from the trunk. You want to see that flare where the root emerges. There is no evidence of that. I think if you were to dig down, the first root is going to be about 3 to 4 inches deep in the soil. We're not burying corpses here. We're planting live plants. So if we were burying a corpse, and this ain't your problem, this is the previous owner's problem, we would have planted it really deep. But we're not burying corpses. We're planting plants. So we want the roots to be very close to the surface. And the reason for that is that roots need oxygen. It's just that's the simplest way I know to say it. They need the oxygen. When you get really deep in the soil, there's no oxygen there, and there's a lot of other problems. You get root wrapping and a lot of other issues. In this case, that was compounded by the fact that I think you've got a wet spot right there. It's a little wetter. Looking at the soil, my suspicion is it's just a little wetter. But the two of those together created a disastrous situation for the crown of that plant, the root crown of that plant, and it began to rot. And now you have glomerella, and glomerella is causing the bark to crack. And I can tell you that the remedy for this at this point is to cut the tree down, because it ain't going to live. There is no way you're going to recover it. Now, you can t- test me and see if I'm right. I guess there is. It's worth testing. but then you're going to be 10 years behind. So cut it out. Do something. Get another one. Figure out what it is you want there and get another one to put there. Make sure that you want a camellia there. When you replant, you can avoid these problems, but here's how you need to do it. Add about 6 inches of pine bark to that area. Pine bark, each piece no bigger than your finger. I say this over and over, but there's a reason I say it. Pine bark, each piece no bigger than your fingernail. Yep, thank you, Charlie. Each piece no bigger than your fingernail. Pine bark about 6 inches deep, as far around there as you can. About a 4 foot circle, okay, of this pine bark. And then plant that camellia and crack the soil underneath it when you pull the other one out. And plant the new camellia so that you can see the root flare coming out at the top into that pine bark. You don't want to plant it too deep. And then about every year you're going to have to come back. For the first 3 years, you'll have to come back with a little more pine bark because we're trying to build up this area just a little bit. And trust me on this, we're building it up to keep the soil from being too wet, which it often is next to a house for a lot of reasons. And then every year come back with about an inch of pine bark to cover that top. But you'll still be able to see the root flare and everything will work out fine. But there's the problem. Now, tell me what you think.
I'm sad to hear it's going, but I had a feeling you're going to say that we had to cut that one down because it looks absolutely pitiful.
Oh, it's terrible. it's just horrible.
There's one next to it. There's four of them there. So I'm kind of a sucker for symmetry, too. So it kind of kills me that I'm going to have a bare spot there. But there's one next to it that has the same cracking at the base. It's not as bad, and it still looks healthy. What can I do to treat that one?
Boy, Heidi. So, one thing.
And, this was the north side of the house. There weren't any gutters.
Right. It just
absolutely was probably the wettest spot around the house.
Yeah. So how did I know? I could tell. So here it is. So, yeah, I think your other one's probably gone, too. There's not much you can do to stop glomerella once it's developed like that. The one thing I will say is don't mulch. The mulch is making it worse, right?
Right.
It's retaining moisture. It's burying the trunk even deeper. I think you may begin rethinking what you got there. If you've got glomerella in another trunk, and raise the soil level just a little bit, and start over. I mean, you can have camellias. I think you've got to my view, you got windows there. And you can actually see out the windows because one of the camellias is dead. But if you had two healthy camellias, you'd be looking at the backside, the ugly backside of a camellia that had no flowers on it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So maybe camellias aren't the thing for that spot. Or maybe just one camellia would be appropriate there.
Well, it sounds like we're about to be down to one or two.
Yeah, right. So there you go. I don't think I'd plant a camellia back just because you actually got windows. North light is the best light. I write about this in my column. I love windows. The north light is the best possible light. Windows that face north are the best possible windows in Gulf Coast houses. And don't rob them of that beautiful, beautiful north light. So plant something a little lower there.
Okay. All right, well, I appreciate it.
Nate, it's good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, man, look at all these questions. Chris, yeah, you could do that, Chris. We could do that. We're going to be back and lots of things to talk about.
Have a little song, won't take long. Sing it right. Or twice, oh Lord, and me, didn't I shake sugary? Everything I got is done and gone. Everything I got is done and gone. chain on everything that was in my name. Oh, Lord of me, didn't I shake sugary? Everything I got is done and gone. Everything I got is done and gone.
Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Samson seems sort of sweaty. Okay, listen. Oh, boy. Have we we've talked about so many things, I can't even keep up with it myself. So I got a great question. Is root flare a conditional process of planting all plants? Should you have root flare on all plants? Let me say this. It's a great question. Root flare is where you can see the root leaving the trunk of a plant. And I will say this. I think it is an important rule for all woody plants. All woody plants. Any plants that has a woody stem, shrub, azaleas, camellias, trees, roses, anything that has a woody stem, that is an important rule. Look for the trunk flare. And the trunk flare the root flare is where the root, that first root emerges from the trunk. I didn't invent this. I didn't make it up. It was the results of a lot of good science and a lot of good science experiments looking at how these things work. And so, particularly out of Florida, in climates very much like ours, and so they know you got to have that root flare. And the reason has to do with if you don't have that root flare, if you don't see that root emerging, the trunk starts wrapping. The roots start wrapping. The roots are buried too deep, and so they don't get enough oxygen. You're not burying Uncle Ned here. What you're doing is you're planting a live plant. It needs to be close to the surface. Those roots need to be close to the surface, as close to the surface as possible, because that's where the oxygen is. And if you plant them too deep, the trunk itself isn't used to that kind of soil. It rots. The roots begin wrapping around the trunk for a lot of good reasons. Chris will tell you this. Chris Francis will tell you all this. He's seen it happen. Now, that is true for every woody plant. I don't want to confuse the issue too much. It is not as true for some flowers, as my mother would say, herbs, plants with soft stems like tomatoes and beans and lots of other things. They actually can tolerate having a little more soil, and sometimes it's good to plant them just a little bit deeper, not much deeper. This crazy thing about planting tomatoes really deep is really a stupid thing. But you can plant them just a little bit deeper, like a half inch deeper than normal. And particularly with plants that are with soft stemmed plants that are floppy, they will often develop side roots. This keeps them from being floppy. There's some small benefits to that. So it's less of a hard rule with the soft stem plants. But hard stem plants always got to see the root flare. Just wanted to clarify that. Have to say that right off the bat. Let's see. What else have I got? You know, Chris, my good friend Chris Francis, we heard us talking about the live oak. Chris, this live oak was a pretty small live oak. It's movable. It's about 5 feet tall. Chris points out that if you're going to move a tree of any size and you really want to be successful at it, you can't get a big enough root ball if you're an average person. You just can't do it because the roots aren't deep. It's not that the roots are deep. It's that they're shallow and extend out a long way. It's good to hire professionals. Sometimes a tree spade can really help in those cases. Tree spades could leave a big hole. You got to figure out how to fill that hole up. But, you know, there it is. And a bigger tree, I would do it. I use caution in suggesting people move bigger trees, but you're going to need more than just if you've got a bigger tree. If it's much bigger than 4 or 5 feet tall, you're going to need some real professional help doing it. And somebody with a tree spade, an arborist who knows what they're doing, is probably necessary. Some great photographs from Johnny down in Grand Bay showing me his beautiful fritillaries hitting his passion flowers, eating the fire, the Gulf fritillaries, eating the fire out of those passion fruit. But you know, they always hit at the right time, don't they, Johnny, which is after the fruits have developed, and everything's just fine. Johnny's going to get his Russian kale seedlings out to the garden. I am too. It's about time to plant, folks. It's about time. It is time to plant. I'm just going to plant. The nights are getting just a little bit cooler. It is the right time to go ahead and get those transplants in the garden. The broccoli, I'm going to go ahead and get my broccoli out this week. I'm going to get the kale out this week. We got one more week that I think it's good. I mean, I think you could do it next weekend as well. It's time. It's time. It's time to get it all out. Dan has sprigged in some bare spots in his yard, and Dan, I think that's a good thing to do. I like sprigging. And if you've got St. Augustine, that's a great way to do it. Find some good St. Augustine, good healthy St. Augustine, and it's a great way to do it. Someone sent me a picture of satsumas that they are picking and eating already, and they say they're juicy and sweet. And I will tell you that if they're good now, they're going to be a lot better in about 3 weeks. Don't pick them all now. Just pick a few. That's a great way to do it. You're finding out. You're going to be able to follow that fruit along and really know when the peak flavor arrives. If the flavor doesn't improve in 3 weeks, I want you to call me and tell me. It's a good way to do it, though. Start now. See how they taste. See how they're good. Oh, man, let's see. I got some Tony. It looks like a slash or a longleaf, Tony. I'll tell you that it is – I can't tell you what it is. I think it's a slash pine. I would say that it has pine bark beetles. I don't know whether they're Ips beetles or – but that tree is a goner. No saving it. Get ready to cut it down. Tony, that's it. And I don't think it was the trimming that did it. I don't think. I do think that it was Ips beetles, and it could have been, I don't know, something caused that. But it was a beetle, and there it is. Earl, I'm listening. What's up?
Good morning. How are y'all?
Good.
I've got some camellias that have the seed ball on them or the pod on them.
Say it again, Earl. I didn't hear that. Got what on it? I'm not hearing.
I've got some camellias.
Yeah.
That have the seed pods on them.
Yeah. Okay. Seed pods on the camellias. Good.
My nephew wants me to cut them off and send them to him.
Well, it's just like any seed, and you can do it. Let it get a little harder, get a little duller green. If it's bright, shiny green, it probably the seed isn't quite ready. Let it get a little bit dull green. When the case gets a little bit dull green, and then you just pick them off. You can use hand clippers, or you can use a knife. Just cut them off and send them to him, and he can grow those from seed.
Okay. About how much longer do you think would be good?
You know, I can't tell you because they all sort of produce at different times, and I'm assuming these were from last year or from this year?
From this year.
From this year. Yeah, I think they're going to need a little more time to develop. It's probably going to be November, but look for that seed capsule to get dull. It's shiny now, right?
Do what?
Is it kind of shiny looking now?
Right.
So let it get a little bit dull. That's usually a signal that it's about ready to go. And I'm thinking that's probably going to happen sometime in November, maybe late November.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll work. It'll work great. And he can have fun. And then in about 10 years, I hope he's got patience. In about 10 years, he'll know whether it's a good camellia or not.
All right.
Earl, good to hear from you. Let me know how that goes.
I sure will. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, Johnny. Charlie, can I talk to Johnny real quick?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm up. I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, Bill. That picture of that pink hibiscus I sent you?
Yes, sir.
That's that one I asked you about a couple weeks ago, I think, that froze down to nothing, and it came back up, and it's grown all the way back up to there. I think I've repotted it once with some potting soil. I was going to ask you, is that the kind of hibiscus I can plant out in the yard, or should that stay in a pot?
Keep it in a pot. It is not going to, you know, and you're colder than I am, as Grand Bay is sometimes, and I could not keep that alive in my yard most winters. So I would say most of the Chinese hibiscus, and this is one of those Chinese hibiscus, it's one of the Asian hibiscus, the tropical hibiscus. It was probably may have been developed in Louisiana, but it's basically got ancestors in Asia. They're tropical, and they're the kind of hibiscus you see in Hawaii, and they will not tolerate temperatures below 27, 28 degrees for long periods of time. So it can
I put it in the garage and will the leaves fall off or something like that, or just go dormant or something? Or
that's right, and that's probably what'll happen. But you can put it in the garage. Here, the thing to do is most days in winter are just fine. So what you do is just put it near the garage, let it get some sunlight on days when the temperature stays in the 40s and 50s, and then upper 40s and 50s, and then when temperatures drop below 40, you just kick it in the garage at the night and then bring it back out again when it warms up.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, it should do great.
Sounds good.
It's looking good. That's a pretty hibiscus.
Yeah, it's good. When I bought it, it was one of those, you know, those Home Depot kind of things, is a nice little round crown of leaves with just covered with those blooms. I probably will never look like that again, but
yeah.
It does look pretty.
Yeah, no, it does look good, and it's going to develop, and it'll develop well. We need to fertilize. They're sensitive to fertilization and to light and to a lot of other things, but it's taken off. It's going to look really good next year.
All right. Well, thanks for your help.
All right, Johnny. Always good to hear from you.
Down to Western. Where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's Coal Train is hauled it away.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Let's see if what questions do I not have answered, if Zipwhip will cooperate here. A question about a fruit tree that's conditioned for our area, a fruit tree that's good. You know, it's always good to sit back and think about that. There's so many fruit trees that are good for Alabama and particularly for Mobile. Which would I start out with? Citrus, or we're very good with citrus. Not all citrus. I like to remind people, and I don't want to get into the arguments, but the citrus that we do really well with are the citrus from the parts of Japan that have a climate similar to ours. And that's things like satsumas. We do great with satsumas. We do really good with satsumas. We do good with calamondins. We do good with Meyer's lemons. They're very good. We do good with the traditional Gulf Coast oranges. This is a very specific, and that's one of them is called, what do they call it? L.A. Early, is that the name of it? Something like that. L.A. Sweet, I'm sorry. Louisiana Sweet is actually probably very similar to a Hamlin. Which is Hamlin and L.A. Sweet, two great citrus for the Gulf Coast, oranges for the Gulf Coast. They're very good. Citrus are great. Persimmons are just – Charlie, do you know what the Latin name for citrus for persimmons are?
I have no idea.
It is Diospyros. And Diospyros means Dios, gods, Pyros, fruit. It is God's fruit. That is the Latin name for persimmons. And I will tell you, it is the fruit of the gods. It is unbelievable. It is one of the really great fruits for our climate. Love those. Loquats are great. They do really well here. Jelly palms do really wonderfully here. Blueberries do great here. Figs do great here. What am I missing? I'm missing lots of things. But these all are very easy plants to grow here. They all do very well. Bananas actually can do very well here, too. I shouldn't forget the bananas. They're good as well. So just some of the grapefruits that are great for us. I have some pictures here of a Japanese magnolia that has just been sent to me. That is a Japanese magnolia, an Asian magnolia that's growing in a yard in, looks like Midtown maybe. Japanese magnolia is what you got. Hey, we said we were going to talk about termites. And let's just talk about termites. I'd probably rather talk about persimmons, but You've heard me talk a lot about persimmons and how we sort of miss the boat on persimmons because we forget where we are. But termites, you know, once termites get into your house, they're a big problem. I always reckon there's no way that an average homeowner is going to be able to take care of that. And I will tell you that the chemicals that are used to control traditionally to control termites are some of the most dangerous chemicals ever. They were really bad, and they're still in some houses. The modern chemicals are probably less bad, but they're still a worry, and I understand that, and it can be very expensive to have a termite treatment. You don't want to have termites in your house. And this is very interesting because nowadays we build as if we don't live in the center of termite country. So we build on slabs. And it can be very difficult to identify and control termite infestation when you live on a concrete slab. I just want to point this out because I have known a lot of people who had repeated termite infestations, some of my good relatives, repeated termite infestations in their walls because the termites had found a way up through the slab, and there was just no easy way to control it. And it was repeated efforts to bring those termites under control. It did a ton of damage. In the meanwhile, it can be a real problem. In the old days, what did people do? I mean, termites have always been here. We have a new species, the Formosans, but, you know, most of this is the old-fashioned, good old southern subterranean termite. What people did in the past was they built houses on piers. It's one of the good reasons for building a house on piers is you can, and particularly if you build it high enough that you can actually inspect underneath it. And by doing that, you can begin to see whether there are any termite tunnels. And it's pretty conspicuous. And they will build on the outside of those piers, and you can check. And it's very easy to control those infestations before they become a problem in your wall. Another thing I think in the old days it probably was very helpful are chickens. People put chickens under their houses. The chickens could find those termite tunnels in no time and peck them and start eating the termites, and it would really keep the termites at bay. There are always going to be termites in your yard, inevitably, from trees falling, from the roots of trees. If you've got any trees within 100 yards of your house, you've got termites, I guarantee, in your yard. There's not anything you can do about that. What you want to do is to provide a barrier between the ground and your house. Piers were a very effective way of doing that. If you have piers and other things, don't dress up the underside of your house in such a way that you can't see anymore whether there's any termite activity or termite damage. The termite inspectors freak out about some of the things we're doing underneath houses now. And if you put insulation under your floors, and it's particularly if it's bad insulation, I can guarantee you if air can circulate around that insulation, I guarantee you your floors are going to stay wet. And if your floors stay wet, that makes them even more attractive to termites. So sort of thinking about where we are, knowing that termites are always here, that's the way to deal with termites, is thinking about how do I isolate my house from these termite infestations. Boy, we've been around the world this morning. We've talked about a lot of great things, a lot of fun things, and had a good time doing it. Had a really good time doing it. So let's do it again next week. I just want to come back and remind you, you know, we live in the land of milk and honey, and taking advantage of it isn't so much about working hard or getting out and mowing and cultivating and doing all these things. if you want to appreciate that you live in the land of milk and honey, you just got to listen and look to where you are. Don't let other people tell you where you are. Don't try to think you live in Fort Wayne, Indiana. You live in Mobile. You live in Fairhope. You live in a very specific part of the world. Go out and eat some persimmons this week. Don't wait for frost. There it is. If they're soft and orange, they're good to eat. There it is. We'll be back next week.